Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Now, in the past few weeks, there have been some really damaging stories that have come up, and we understand that bridging that divide has become so much more problematic. We've got the Breonna Taylor situation. We've got the Ahmaud Arbery situation. We've got Amy Karen Cooper in New York. And of course, we have the George Floyd incident. So this work has really been an uphill battle before, but considering what's going on recently, that uphill climb has seemed to have gotten a little bit steeper. So I wanted to have a conversation about what's going on. And unfortunately, so many times when there is a divide between the police and the community, generally that divide is based upon race, generally, not always, but generally, especially here in America and especially in these recent times. So I reached out to a young lady. Her name is Miss, or Dr. actually, Tahari Jackson. And so what happened was she wrote an article, and the name of the article is "I'm White and I'm Outraged by the Ahmaud Arbery Killing. Now What?" So she wrote the article. I was really impressed by the article, decided to reach out to her. She was so gracious and so kind enough to come onto the podcast and discuss the article. So that's what we're going to be discussing today, not only the article, but we're going to be discussing the current state of affairs between law enforcement and the public, and what's going on with the Ahmaud Arbery killing, what's going on with the George Floyd killing, what's going on in the minds of these different so-called Karens, right? Amy Cooper, and just a whole bunch of other stuff. So she's going to help us to try to unpack that. She does racism work. She is a professor. She's got a couple degrees from Harvard University, got her PhD from Emory University. And so she's a highly educated and very knowledgeable woman. I know that you're going to be very impressed with the interview that we have for today. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Dr. Tahari Jackson.
I think our timing is impeccable. You know, I think originally we were probably going to talk about some other, you know, aspects, but I have been on the struggle bus lately because I almost wrote an article entitled, you know, "Same Story, Different Day," you know, or like, you know, I want to stop writing these, but the news keeps happening. Life keeps happening. So this is just a great opportunity for us, for me. I can't speak for you, but this will be a great opportunity for me to sort of work through my pain, you know, which always becomes our passion. But yeah, I probably need this, you know, so don't thank me. I'm grateful to you and your work. So thank you.
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate it. And I've reached out to a PhD in psychology, and we did the Arbery situation.
Yes.
And then I had another law professor, and we did the Arbery situation again, right? So I did it from the legal aspect and, of course, from the psychological aspect of Black people seeing all these different snuff films.
Right.
And, you know, as soon as we finished that, and I actually released that episode with the psychologist on Sunday, Sunday, before, and then the next day, we get hit with this. I didn't even call him back. I'm like, you know what? I'll just, and I think at that time we had decided to talk already.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I did, so it's just been, as you said, the hits just keep on coming. It's really, really traumatic, and it's really, really disgusting. And all these different adjectives that I run out of, you know, whenever I'm trying to do this kind of stuff. So, let me thank you again, Dr. Tahari. You got it. If I butcher your name, please.
Tahari? No.
Okay.
Tahari.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Tahari Jackson. I got the last name. At least I can say the last name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for coming on the podcast, so once again, thank you, Dr. Tahari Jackson, for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, really appreciate it. I think that you are looking more, and I look forward to my episodes, but from your emails and stuff, you're really looking forward to it. I'm like, well, she's really excited. So yeah. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your pedigree, your history, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, Well, I guess professionally, that's probably the most relevant thing. So
Take us from the beginning.
Okay. Well, in the beginning, there was my parents. So no. One question that I always like to address in the beginning is people are, what are you? So how do you identify? So I identify as multiracial. So my parents are both, my mom's biethnic, my dad's triracial. I am originally from Roanoke, Virginia. My mother is an immigrant from Bangkok, Thailand. Her mother is Thai. Her father is from India. So she's half Thai and half Indian. My father has a lovely pedigree. He grew up in Callaway, Virginia, in Franklin County, actually, moonshine capital of the world. And he is the son of a passing white lady. So just a blonde-haired, blue-eyed looking white lady and a wonderful farmer, hog farmer, who was half black and half Cherokee. So I actually identify as multiracial because, people are sometimes not able to pay attention fully until they can answer that question and place me ethnically. So I just thought I would start there. Grew up in Virginia and, with regard to my education, always public schools. Went to Harvard originally to be a doctor, a pediatric neurosurgeon, but then ended up staying and getting an education degree and then later a PhD in teacher education, multicultural education, and urban education reform. So for the better part of 17 years, I've been a professor of education, a teacher of teachers, so a teacher educator, but always a professor of things like minority and urban education. And then I've always had one foot in academia, one foot in consulting. So as I simultaneously was a professor, I was also a consultant for companies, corporations, nonprofits, universities, school systems. So I could basically help people do their best work in peace, right, with regard to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. So that's kind of the short version of my bio. I hope that was informative, instructive.
No, definitely. Thank you so much. I always like to try to get a little flavor of the guests that I have. So the reason that I reached out to you is because of the article that I saw that was published in Medium, I believe, and I didn't print it out because I'm foolish. So let me, the name of the article is "I'm White and I'm Outraged by Ahmaud Arbery's Murder, Now What?" So as I reached out to you about that particular article, in the meantime, we get hit with George Floyd. Yes. We get hit with Breonna Taylor. I'm not sure of the orders of these either. We get hit with Breonna Taylor. We get hit with Karen Amy Cooper in New York. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm pretty sure that Cooper in Floyd happened the same day. I'm pretty sure that they happened the same day. But regardless, it is a little glimpse into the world of African Americans, and so this is really going to be a struggle for me to really try to get through this because I've done so many talks about this already, and it's just so devastating to have to continue to relive. But it's worth it because we need to get this pain out. Now, your work in anti-racism is really going to be profound and really going to help us to try to understand some things. So why don't we begin with trying to understand what your work is and why it's necessary and all that kind of stuff. What exactly is it that you do in it?
Yeah, you know what? Even as I'm explaining sort of what I do, let me talk about sort of how I do it and my approach and my viewpoint, right? So I have always been a part of a conversation about diversity, equity, inclusion, right? When I first began, literally my first semester as an adjunct professor, I had signed up to teach human development and psychology. But because of the way I look, they were like, can you teach this diversity class? So I've been teaching about diversity to teachers and to lots of different audiences for almost 20 years now. And the way I do it is a little bit different. I don't focus on what's called the downward gaze, right? I don't just look at minorities and people of color and say, well, here's what they're doing and here's what you need to get right. Here's how to fix yourself. Here's how to solve your own problem. Here's how to heal yourself. And that's true for any group, right? So if I'm going to work on, domestic violence and sexism, I'm going to work with men, right? Because that those are male problems, right? And they have the power to create sexist conditions. If I'm going to work on, you know, homophobia, I'm going to work with straight people, right? Because we have the power to create homophobic conditions. So now when I'm thinking about race, and thinking about anti-racism, I'm going to work with white people. Because white people have the most racial power, and they have the power to create racist and also subsequently anti-racist conditions. So I have always focused on what's called the upward gaze, right? I'm always looking at the empowered group to do the work because, you know, Black people, for example, people of color, we're not broken, right? We don't need fixing, and we can't fix this by ourselves because we are not in a position of racial power. So in all of the anti-racism sort of equity, diversity work that I've done, I have always focused on the groups in power. You know, how do you get a feminist man? You know, how do you get an anti-racist white person? How do you get an anti-homophobic straight person? How do you get an anti-faithist Christian? How do you motivate people who are empowered groups to become activists and allies for people who are dissimilarly situated? That's really what I study. And so if we're about to talk about my work, I'll pause and just a second, but I started out by studying anti-racist white teachers. And then when I realized that, you know, 82 to 90% of teachers nationwide are white, I thought, well, who's teaching teachers? So I started researching anti-racist teacher educators, right? And very public figures who work with teachers and who are anti-racist, people like Tim Wise, Jane Elliott, Joe Feagin, you know, Christine Slater, some of these big names, you know, big names in anti-racism. So I just wanted to make it clear that the way I do this work is that I'm not just going to focus on the people who are oppressed, because we're not broken, right? Whether it's women or people on the LGBTQ plus spectrum, I'm going to focus on the group that has the most power to help us, right? And to change those conditions. So that's how I see anti-racism. And I've been working with, you know, I guess you would say woke white people or critically conscious, you know, culturally sustaining, whatever you want to say. I've been working with those white people for years, and that's my research. And that's the work I do.
These woke white people that you work with, are they a captive audience? Are they open to it? You know, my experience in law enforcement has been, you know, I was an implicit and biased instructor. Of course, I've been Black. I don't know if you can tell that, but I'm African American, and you know, I've been that all my life. And so, I sitting in these classes with these people, you know, I can see and almost hear their eyes rolling in their heads as we're talking about all this type of stuff, right? So, of course, you know, the police world is filled with a bunch of, how's the best way to say this? You know, macho, hyper-aggressive, super-aggressive, you know, testosterone-filled men, right? So, I guess my question is, you know, I'm coming from it from that perspective of what I see. You're sitting in a classroom teaching other teachers, right, who are probably more empathetic to human experience, little kids and all that kind of stuff. Well, I could tell by the look in your face we're going to have a serious conversation here. So I'll let you jump in there.
So is your question right? So it's interesting that you're talking about the law enforcement context, right? And by the way, I think that your work there is crucial. And I think that there's the solidarity of the police officers that we've been seeing, right? People who are taking, you know, Colin Kaepernick style knees with protesters.
I got a lot to say about that.
But the appearance thereof, right, is very hopeful, right? It's very hope inspiring. The sheriff in Flint who said, "What do you need from us? Okay, let's put down our riot gear. Let's walk with you." I am so inspired by that because I one of the things that I wanted to address is that, you know, when you talk about, you know, you and I doing this work. Because I just got hired to do implicit bias training and to focus on things, you know, in the field of biomedical research. I'm sort of transitioning from a military context because I just finished working at the Department of Defense. So, you know, if you can imagine militarized, mostly white, mostly male, mostly white, mostly male, hyper testosterone, you know, they're very similar contexts. But I guess what I want to say is, you know, I am encouraged by cross-cultural coalitions, right? Or you always have to have a cross-cultural coalition. So the way that women got the right to vote was that we had lots of men out there, right? Like protesting with us, like really sort of, you know, and when we think about the civil rights movement, which is kind of what I'm reminded of now, especially with, you know, threats of releasing vicious dogs and shooting and some of the more unhelpful things that are coming from the White House, it makes me think about those young white freedom riders. It makes me think about those white people, right? Like if you just look at visuals of the civil rights movement, which were, by the way, were started off as peaceful protests, you always see people in cross coalition. So I know what it's like to steer into a group of mostly white people, right? So again, teaching, education, 82 to 90% white, primarily white women, white monolingual women, who are middle class and from suburbs. Like it's a very specific demographic. And I know what it's like to stare out into a sea of white icebergs, right? Where people are cold to the message, they're cold to the messenger. It's just, it's difficult, right? That's an almost intractable circumstance. But this is their work, right? This is their work. When we think about racism, the work is white people's because they have the most racial power, right? Again, we think about things like sexism, the work is for men because you have the power to create sexist conditions. So I'm inspired by the work that's happening, you know, whether it's by individual policemen or people like you who are working, around and within law enforcement from inside. But, you know, if we give up on the empowered groups and if we give up on these ice cold, like I said, rooms full of white icebergs, then racism wins because they are the very ones who need to be in there, right? And so that's kind of what I want to say in response to some of the things that you've experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that many of these people, and this is probably going to tie into another article, let me pull it up here, that you wrote. Mm-hmm. This was an article that you wrote some time ago, Who's Afraid of the Browning of America, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, do you think that many of these people, well, let me ask you this way. What is the reason that many of these people we're still dealing with this, right? I saw a sign that said, I'm 66 years old, and the protest is. I'm 66 years old. Do you see that sign? And I'm still protesting this. This is an elder by white lady.
Yes.
Why? Why? What's up with this? I mean, the 60s. What's up with this?
Yeah. So I have a hopeful answer to that, but I'll start with the more cynical one, right? Racism has a purpose and a function. Racism is profitable. In the article, I don't know if you had a chance to read the article that I wrote this morning about, you know, if you're more outraged by the destruction of personal property than the destruction of Black lives, your outrage is misplaced, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually talk about the genesis of racism, right? I talk about the inception of enslavement in this country, which was 1619, just literally 12 years after we got a good footing on this land. So I talked about how racism is fundamental to this country's founding, right? It's not aberrant. It's not on the side. It's not a cancer. It's not an accident. It is fundamentally interwoven into our fabric because it was profitable, right? We had a large land, which we first occupied and then essentially stole from various indigenous groups and from Mexican Americans, right? And we needed free labor, right? Like we needed a society that was built on free labor. So we dehumanized a group of people all the way over in Africa, and we brought them here. And that established a still going system of white racial dominance, right? And what goes along with that is that white people are socialized, have been socialized for centuries through hoodoo science, right? To believe that they are better than literally every other person of color. Better than the Mongoloids, you know, better than Native Americans, better than Latinx folks, literally better than everybody else. And that they should be in charge, that they should be in leadership, and that they should be on top and in control of entire industries, in control of lawmaking, in control of law enforcement, right? So when your entire country is rooted in a system of white racial dominance, that takes almost as long as the establishment of that system to sort of dismantle. But the good news is that racism is not inherently innate. Now, I know you spoke to a psychologist. My first two degrees are actually in psychology too. So I'm saying this with a little bit of imprimatur, but racism is learned. It's a learned behavior, right? So anything that can be learned can be unlearned. Anything that is manufactured can be dismantled, and anything that is created can be destroyed. The reason that it's taking so long to dismantle racism, because we don't want to forget about all the progress, right? Like, you know, I can marry a white man, you know, like we don't want to forget about racial progress, right? Like there's always going to be some racial progress. But part of the reason that it's so difficult to eradicate racism is, number one, it's still profitable, right? This is a capitalistic society, so it's still a moneymaker. And then number two, power is comfortable. Right? Power is comfortable. And so, you know, white people are like, but if we give up our power status, you know, for example, like in as early as 2042, it's being projected by the Pew Research Center that the number of people of color and the number of white people in the United States is going to equalize, right? And there are white people who are terrified by that. There are neo-Nazis who go around chanting, you know, you will not replace us. But and they're just speaking their fears. They're saying, you are going to replace us in leadership. We've already had a half black president. You're going to replace us in the best jobs. Oh, no. You're going to replace us in universities, you know, and you're going to replace us in these institutions that we have traditionally kept for ourselves, right? And that's terrifying for white people because they only know power and control, and that's comfortable. And, you know, I'll just leave you with this. Some of my colleagues in academia say white people's worst fear is that we will treat them exactly the way they treat us. That's ultimately the fear, right? Like we can't let go of our dominant status because the moment we do that, we're going to know what it's like to be oppressed. And we don't want that. I don't think that people of color would rule that way. I know for a fact we wouldn't. But yeah, I think that's the other fear. White people do not want to be treated the way deep down they know we are treated every day. And that's a real concern of theirs.
Yeah, well, I think that's well said. And, you know, I've been hearing that for years. It's the way I've always thought is that that is their number one fear, is that if and when other people get into power, that they will be treated that particular way.
Yeah. And just the best way that I've ever heard that described is inverted our turnism. They are concerned about inverted our turnism. Now that we are in power, now that we are in positions to oppress you, it's our turn to take revenge and to be vengeful in the same ways that you have all these centuries, right? Not just years, but like centuries. And I don't think that white people should have that fear because if anything, you want people in power who understand what it is to be oppressed and who understand what it is to have someone's foot on your neck. Literally and figuratively. That's who you want in power.
You know, like you said, we had a half black or black president, you know, the one drop rule or whatever it was.
Yes.
And what did he do? He gave you health care and you didn't want that. So, I mean, some of these people that they just start to really think, you know, they could really make some real serious progress.
Right.
So you wrote this article after the Ahmaud Arbery lynching, assassination, murder, you know, all the above there.
Public execution. Yes.
Public execution.
Street trial.
Yeah. Yeah. The good old boys there just going to get their shot, shoot them up gun and, you know, just go round up the posse and all that kind of stuff. Very traumatic. So tell us about why you wrote the article. Well, we know why, but you know, tell us in your words, why you wrote the article, what you're hoping to achieve and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so I think this is a good fundamental question is sort of why I write it all, because I have not written, I'm coming from the land of academia where you write these articles and really only the other people in your community, you know, it's very incestuous. Like we write and we cite each other and you have to pay for these journals or have a subscription.
Yeah, I know you have to pay for them. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, so so the idea that you would be opening up your ideas to the public is a little bit scary to me. But I've always sort of been writing a few things here and there that the public could consume because the public needs to know, right? Like, and I one thing that I'm gonna, that I've been thinking about lately is that what we need right now is leadership and a president and an explainer in chief. And if we're not going to get an explainer in chief who can sort of help people understand what's happening, who can ground the protests in centuries of persecution and mutilation and torture and enslavement. If we don't have an explainer in chief, then I will be an explainer in chief, right? Like, I'm not the president. I have no political designs. But part of the reason that I'm writing publicly is that people need to be able to work through their understandings of race, anti-racism, these murders, these killings. Amy Cooper calling the police on, you know, my Harvard brother, Christian Cooper. Like, people are aching to understand. And again, very hopeful. I'm a perpetual optimist. The other reason that I write, and I'll get specifically to that article, but the other reason that I write, especially in a public forum now, is because my inboxes are full of white people. Well-meaning, serious, dedicated white people who are saying, Dr. Jackson, I read your article or I'm familiar with your work. What do I do? One woman in Arizona actually sent me a physical email to my personal address that said, I am ready to get uncomfortable. I'm white. I'm outraged. I agree with every single thing you said in your article. And I need you to tell me what to do next, right? Because the danger of just writing, you know, and emoting and working through my pain and my passion that way is that you can't lead people down a 2,000-mile road with nowhere to go, right? Like, you have to help people get to where they want to be in their anti-racist journey. So the reason I wrote the Ahmaud Arbery article on his birthday is because several years I had to write an article about Jordan Davis, who was playing loud music in Florida and was shot and murdered and killed in his own car, right, in Florida. So I had written that article on Racism Review and on his birthday because I couldn't sleep. When here we are, I think it's maybe 6 or 7 years later, and I couldn't sleep on Ahmaud Arbery's birthday because I couldn't believe, I was trying to process what it would mean for me as a person of color to shoot two white joggers in my neighborhood and then have nothing done and just go back into my home and just be in here quarantining like nothing ever happened. I was trying to understand what that would be like, and I couldn't, because that's not how that would go down. So I was outraged. I know the title of the piece is I'm White and I'm Outraged, and that was to make sure I could capture the right target audience, which is these anti-racist white people who are on the cusp of really wanting to be allies and what I call accomplices, but don't know where to go and don't know what to read and don't know what to do. But I was outraged. You know, that could have been my brother is a dark-skinned, multiracial, but, black man, right? He's a black-presenting, ominous, black presence to the rest of society, and he could get gunned down, right, in his own neighborhood. And we should all be outraged by that as humans, not as colored people, not as white people, but as humans, right? We should all be outraged by that.
Well, we should be, but unfortunately, I don't think that enough of us are. Now, I do think that, I'm going to ask a long question here. I do think that the Arbery situation started us on this way, and I wanted to ask you why now, right? We had Jordan Davis, we had Tamir Rice, we had Eric Garner, we had Stephon Clark, we had Philando Castile.
Yes.
And, I was an officer at this time, once again, working with mostly white persons when this is going down. And I can remember going back and forth with these guys like, are you guys kidding me? Why now? Why now? And this is going to tie into not only Arbery, but with Mr. Floyd. What's different now? What's different? We've had video for some time now, at least the last 10 years or so. What's different? We've seen all this stuff. In your estimation, what's the outrage now? Why did that particular person write you that email from Arizona? What was so different about all this?
Well, I mean, it's related to my answer earlier. I do some work with executives and leadership, and even the last research I did as a professor was about how to maintain these fantastic teachers. But I ended up studying school principals and administrators and superintendents and leaders, and I started calling them tone setters in chief. Right? Because you can only make so much racial progress in your organization as is allowable by your tone setter in chief or by your leader. We have a racist in chief. We have a sexist in chief. We have a xenophobe in chief. We have a white nationalist in chief. We have a classist in chief. Okay. So the reason that people are coming to every day, Sid, I'm not, you know, famous by any means, right? Like, I'm just a regular woman out here. I'm a diversity consultant. I'm a regular lady. But the reason that people are so desperate for my leadership, right? For my suggestions, for articles. Do you have a resource list? Can you come and speak? What about a webinar? Can you do this? Can you help us with a strategic plan? The reason they're so hungry for that is because there's no leadership coming from this country. Right. If anything, this man is the antithesis of what we need. So when you say why now, right, like why are people coming to regular people like me or coming to my academic friends or my professor colleagues? It's because they're looking for leadership. We have no captain on this ship. Right. I mean, my boss is a 3-star Navy admiral. Like, we have no captain on this ship. We have no leader. We have no commander right now. We have a racist in chief. And so I think that people read what I write because what I'm writing is honest, right? The best way to respect people is to tell them the truth. So the white people who get offended and write crazy things in my comments, first of all, they didn't read the article. You can always tell. They're just trolls. And number two, they're not ready to receive it. They're not looking for leadership. They're looking to remain fully entrenched in their racism. Right. But the people, the overwhelming majority of people who seek me out, read my work, send me private messages, those people are aching and those people are hurting. I'll just end here because I know I give verbose answers, but
no. Don't rush. Yeah. Take your time.
Thank you. So the other night at 1 o'clock in the morning, I got a text message from an Army 06, right? This is a full bird colonel in the Army ranks, high level 30-year vet, you know, person. He's active Army. And his text was just, "I can't stop weeping." And then the next one was, "Dr. Jackson, you have to help me." Right? Now, this is an African-American man, right? So I know we've talked a lot about the white people who come, but I think this is worth mentioning. This is an African-American man, right? This is a man who is dripping with masculinity, who has been socialized to believe that he can't emote and he can't cry and he can't feel. But in the middle of the night, this man said, "I am crying, I'm weeping inside, and I need you to help me." And what he has PTSD, so I didn't know like where that was going. But what he was asking me for was, how can I circumvent my restrictions as a Department of Defense employee, as an active Army full bird colonel, and as a technical federal employee? I want to protest and I want to speak out. And I have to speak out because I have a Black wife, a Black son, and a Black daughter. I'm a Black man and I have to speak out. I need you to help me find the proper channel to express my pain and work through my anguish. So we did that. Well, between 1 and 4 a.m., I sent resources, I sent examples, and we did that. But so it's not just white people who are looking, you know, it's funny because I write these articles with white people in mind, but an awful lot of people of color read them, right? Because they need to be able to forward that to the white people in their social circles, or they need to have my article as a response to an ignorant comment from someone in their circle, right? So it's used by everyone, but even though it's targeted to white Americans. So I just wanted to mention that example because everyone is looking for leadership. Everyone is looking for an answer and a plan for what to do in these times because the president is not providing that. And that's a shame.
So you actually think you've called him a racist and all that kind of stuff. You actually believe that he is he stoking the fires? You actually believe that he is a racist or plays in racism adjacent ideas or what?
So I think the president is highly problematic in several ways, but I think that his being in the White House, right, the highest office, elected office in the land, he has enabled racists, right? We always are so gentle in the media and we talk about his base. Well, you know, his base, right? We saw his base. There's a reason that when people are taking assault rifles to state capitals to protest stay at home orders and, you know, wear a mask restrictions.
I want a haircut.
Yeah, a lot of them had Trump 2020 banners. Not all of them, right? I'm not going to cast all of them as sort of these staunch Trump-supporting Republicans, but a lot of them had Trump signs or MAGA hats, right? So he, and what was his response to that? Well, you know, the governors really should talk to them and they should make a deal. You know, these are good people, you know, just like those Charlottesville neo-Nazis. These are good people on both sides. So not only does his presence in the White House enable a nationally sanctioned racist dialogue and sexist dialogue and anti-immigrant dialogue and anti-female, like all the things, all the isms. Not only does his presence enable that thinking, it emboldens people, right? It emboldens people who were like, yeah, Trump 2020, MAGA, you know, because those are all code words for, I don't want immigrants here either. I don't like Black people either. I don't respect women either. Like, these are people who are saying, look, this man is president and it's finally okay. The unspeakable has now become unspeakable, right? And he's, and just a last word about, you know, talking about, does he stoke the fire? You know, what I've learned about him is, he's a great marketer, but he's also a good con artist in the sense that when everything you do is outrageous, nothing you do is outrageous. When everything you say is outrageous, nothing you say is outrageous. This man has so incredibly lowered the bar on what it means to be a decent human being, let alone a strong American leader, that we don't expect anything from him. That's why I'm saying, like, people who contact me, little old Tahari Jackson, they don't expect anything from the White House, right? They don't expect anything from the federal government. So they're coming to people like me because we have no leadership on anti-racism in this country. He's making it worse. He's making it worse.
I 10,000% agree with everything you just said. I think he's making it worse. I think he is a monster. I cannot believe the incident that happened the other day when he tear gassed their own citizens just to have a photo. I can't believe that's not illegal. I have not heard anyone say, and I've been looking for any article, any news person, someone to say what he did was illegal. These weren't, like you said, these are peaceful protesters. They're not rioting. They're not throwing stuff. Even though the White House did say these people were throwing stuff, I was watching the news when it happened. I was, watching CNN. I didn't see anything getting thrown. They just kind of wanted to bulldoze them out of there just so he could take a picture in front of a church. Ridiculous. So I agree with you that he's stoking these fires. And I try to stay away from politics, but I think in your line of work, it's really important because we're talking about anti-racist, and we have a racist or one who at least plays in that racist bullpen in chief. I think that he, his wife, Melania, who was supposed to be on some type of anti-bullying campaign, right? That was her stick, right? And we've got the biggest cyber bully who's ever existed. It's just no one could ever write a script, a Hollywood script on how bad this presidency would be. But like you said, his base loves this man. I just don't understand it. But of course we understand now that he's playing to people who want to maintain their supremacist ideologies. So some people, as we mentioned before, are just scared. I want you to take us through what you thought when you saw Arbery, and take your time, you know, there's no need to rush. When you saw Arbery's execution, I assume that you watched the video. Yes. And then take us to Floyd, if you would, and we'll start to progress from there. What were your emotions? What was going on in your mind?
So I love the news. I'm a news junkie. My military dad and I grew up drinking coffee and watching the news. So I am a news junkie. I have seen those videos too many times that for mental health. and that's the type of thing that I would seek out anyway in my line of work. Right? I always want to know the latest headlines or the latest stories. Those, I have not watched the news in probably over a week now, because it's no longer, I have reached this point of saturation of the trauma that I can receive through my eye gates. But I will tell you this. So the first thing that I think, because I've seen this film over and over, right? It's a different man, different man, same story, right? Same film, same plot line.
Insert name here, right? Dead Black American, insert name here.
I literally wrote that in the article because I knew it was going to be timeless. And I almost didn't put his name in the title because I thought, well, this isn't bound by Ahmaud Arbery. So tomorrow it'll be George Floyd. Okay. So, but here's where I get afraid when I watch those videos because I know the racist playbook. Okay. So first of all, we would never even be hearing about the death of these men if someone hadn't recorded it. Okay. And in the Arbery case, it's interesting, right? Because he actually recorded it purposefully so he could sort of exonerate the murderers, right? So it's interesting that we could have never gotten that. Can you imagine? Like they just would be in their houses, like if we had never seen that. Okay. So first of all, racist playbook, we see the video. Okay. But then what happens is, because people of color, especially Black people and especially Black men, are stereotyped as just being a crime waiting to happen, probably a criminal if not for the crime he committed in that moment, dangerous, shiftless, lazy, inherently bellicose, and malevolent. What happens immediately after we see with our own eyes a Walter Scott get shot, right, in the back, or, is that what the media will do, and what whiteness, you can't even really blame the media all by itself, but what whiteness will do is that it will try to turn that story and spin that story into, but why was he there? What was he doing? Trayvon Martin, what was he wearing? What did he have in his pockets? Did he have the hood up? Right. So then we start getting these questions, right, to insert dubiousness about whether this man deserved what my eyes just saw. My eyes don't deceive me. Now, I am slightly myopic. I do wear glasses. But what I saw was a murder. What I saw, and I know we're not talking about George Floyd yet, but I'm sorry, when I saw that video over and over, irrespective of what happened, an alleged skirmish, a scuffle, him resisting getting in the car, irrespective of what happened, did you not hear him say that he couldn't breathe? do you not process that 8 minutes, 9 minutes, however many minutes, 8 minutes and 34 seconds, do you not process that that is excessive force? And did you not care about the outcome, right? Because that Derek Chauvin looked like he was comfortable there, and that he wanted an outcome, then that he was not going to get up, move, do anything differently. Can you imagine what would have happened if we hadn't seen that video, right? So when I see these videos, the first thing I think is, thank God there's a video. Thank goodness for smartphones. I always try to keep mine charged because you never know, right? Secondly, here comes the backlash. Remember in the Maude Arbery case, the attorney Lee Merritt, they started to release these videos of a previous encounter that he had had with those police in Brooklyn. Yeah. But it was even more incriminating. Because from my understanding, and again, I wasn't there, he was actually in a park in his personal vehicle, minding his business. And what I remember from that video is that there was a white police officer who attempted to tase him, right? He was shirtless, not on a coat, but there was an actual attempt to tase him, even though I could see both his hands at the side. So basically, first there's the video, number one, thank goodness for the videos. Then there is the turning, the spin of the story, right? So what did this man do to deserve this? Even with Amy and Christian Cooper, well, what happened before he started filming? Did he threaten her life? Did he make her feel uncomfortable? Did he have an ominous press? So that to me is where it becomes, there's a real declination of integrity of the whole process. Because as soon as we start asking questions about what these Black men do to deserve dying in like dogs in the street, that's how you know whiteness and white racial dominance is at play. Because you're looking for any excuse whatsoever to justify the murder of a man that we all just saw die for no reason, or for a reason that would never have warranted that his life, right, or her life. So that's the playbook. We're going to invert the story. Then we're going to maybe going to arrest the police. In the case of Amber Geiger and Botham John, they didn't even want to arrest her. I mean, so for whatever reason, and then the police, like, they'll put him on administrative leave, or they'll put him on destitute. I mean, you know better than I do some of the very light disciplinary measures. Derek Chauvin had 18 previous complaints. How are you still a beat cop? How are you still allowed to interact with the public if you have that preponderance of complaints? Help me understand, right? So what we really are protesting, and what I really get offended by, is the hesitancy to even charge, right? Much less fairly try and then fairly convict and indict these people. Because basically what happens at the end of all that playbook, right, from the video to the non-conviction, right, especially in things like Freddie Gray, is that what we see as Black people, what you teach us, is that you can kill us in the street with no consequence. It doesn't even matter what happened in the meantime. It doesn't matter that you caught it on video. It doesn't matter that the person who died was all the way right. It doesn't matter that you couldn't assassinate their character, Botham John. Oh, you found a little marijuana in his apartment? Really? How is that relevant to a man who was killed while eating ice cream on his sofa? Okay. So, and then we had some light charges, which only maybe got filed because of public outrage, because we tried him in the court of public opinion. And at the end of all that, they're going to probably not be convicted. That's how that plays out. And all of this is why we protest. Because what you're saying to us is we can kill you without consequence because your life doesn't matter, right? Your life doesn't matter. We don't value it. We're not even remorseful or regretful that you lost it. Actually, you didn't lose it. We took it, but whatever. That's why people are burning things down.
Well, I agree, and that's well said. And, you know, as your colonel that you talked to, as he felt, I felt the same way. I talked to chiefs, police chiefs. I talked to regular people, and we're all outraged. Some people I've seen on Facebook, Black Americans who were in the camp of white supremacist thinking, right? Always looking for the excuse, or this guy was high, or Trayvon Martin was was suspended. You know, what does that have to do? What are you talking about? So even some of them are like, you know what, this is too much. And that's why I'm asking, why is it now? What's different about Trayvon Martin and Botham Jean and all these Walter Scott, which the Walter Scott decision to me is the most tragic thing in history, because we saw this man plant evidence. We saw it. We saw this man shoot this man in the back, plant evidence. And then we know he lied in this police report. And it was once again only because of video that they tried to arrest the guy with the video, right? He was harassed or something along those lines.
Uh-huh. With Eric Garner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He actually did time, right? He was in county. Yeah.
Yes.
So listen, I'm a police officer at this time. So there's a certain biting of the tongue that goes on. But even then, we're like, listen, this can't happen. I'm a higher ranking. I was probably a lieutenant at the time. So I'm controlling my roll calls and talking to the people so I can have a little bit more input. But it's unbelievable as we talk to these different people as to what their thought process is. And I wrote down, I want to talk to you about that thought process and how you address that. This white innocence that they come with, that, you know, Black people are menacing, as you said, but there's always this idea of white innocence. And just think about this as you ask it. I can remember in the previous Olympics that were held in China, there was, I don't know if you remember this, there was these, I think they were swimmers or something like that. They got in trouble, right? They went outside of their boundaries they were supposed to be in the city that they were supposed to be in. They went somewhere and caused some kind of trouble, and they got arrested by the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. And so I'm watching Channel 4 News with Al Roker, you know, and he's on there. And of course, they got other people. And the guy that he's talking to is a white guy. And he's saying, you know, these kids, they went over here and did this, you know, so, but the Chinese government shouldn't hold them. And Al's like, and I'm thinking at the same time, these aren't kids, they're 34 years old. Right, so there's just what, you know, I'm saying this to say there's white innocence, this assumption that these guys are kids. But meanwhile, if we're 8 years old as Black men, 8 or 12 years old, whatever it is, we're menacing, we're a danger, we got to be tased when you can see our hand and all that kind of stuff. So speak to the point of white innocence if you can.
I'd like to do that. And then if you don't mind, I want to go back to the point that you're making about what it's like to be a police.
Take all the time you need.
Okay, good. So with the white innocence, I already have the bones of this article set up, right? How whiteness works, right? Because this is important, right? And what I do in this article, I've been teaching this for years, but I finally sort of put it all together and I'm going to write it up. But what I do is just juxtapose what it's like to be white and then what it's like not to be white, right? So the assumption of innocence, right? The benefit of the doubt, the assumption of benevolence, and then the assumption of criminality. I'll give you a very specific example about, the other day I was talking to my best friend. She's literally one of the only people that I was able to just take a brief phone call for something else about. She talked about how a white man in her LinkedIn feed had talked about how he had gotten a counterfeit bill, you know, from an ATM machine and tried to use it. And then they had a good laugh about it. And he said, the only difference between myself and George Floyd is that I'm white with a tie. Because apparently, you know, one of the issues that it's related to George Floyd is that, I don't know if he was trying to use counterfeit bills but for some reason, you know, this was interviewed. And then there were several other comments in the link from other white men who were like, yeah, I didn't even realize you could get, you know, counterfeit bills from an ATM. I tried it and I just put it back in my pocket. proceeded to eat my lunch. Police were never called. We laughed it off and I went on about my happy white life, right? A white woman said the same thing. You know, yes, I did. So basically what we're seeing in this thread, it's a thread about white empowerment and white privilege. And it's about how whiteness works, right? About how you as a white person, you can actually do something criminal, right? I mean, we saw this with the sort of stay at home protest. You can actually break the law. You can leave your home for a non-essential trip. You can take a literal AK-47 or AR-15. You can brandish said weapon. You can go to a state house. You can threaten the lives of government officials. You cannot wear a mask. You can have zero gloves on, no PPE. You can shout in the face of an on-duty police officer, and then you can go home to your happy white life. There will be no rubber bullets. There will be no tear gas. There will be no detainment. You will not be arrested. And you will get buttressed. You will actually get supported by your president, right? By your president of the United States, who says, yeah, you should talk to them. You should make a deal. That is the difference, right? That is the day and night difference. This notion of a curfew now, right, as an additional layer of legality, right? So you may be peacefully protesting, but now you're out post 7 p.m. Now you're out post 8 p.m. And so now we're going to start criminal records for all these protesters who are protesting the fact that murderous cops should also have criminal records. What kind of thick irony is that? So I appreciate the question, because you're saying, help me understand how we even get to the point where when white men, I mean, I've got this in the article today, the most violent acts like school shootings, the most egregious acts of school violence, for example, are almost always carried out by white males. Right. And that narrative is, well, they were lone gunmen. They were bullied. We need to do more about mental health. They always just represent themselves. We have Dylan Roof, right, in the Carolinas, who shot up a church. They took that young man to get some fast food on the way to jail, okay? And he was not presumed. This man had literally just shot up 9 people, but even then, he was still in his whiteness. Because a white body, you know, you are generally a good person. We give you the benefit of the doubt, and we don't know what led you down this aberrant road, right? This is not normal for you. Whereas for a black person, this is part of your everyday profile. So that's what I'll say about white innocence. But I want to just go back quickly to what you're saying about what it means to be a policeman, right? Or what it meant for you. Are you retired at this point?
I'm retired, yes. Yes.
Okay. So what it meant for you to go through Eric Garner and some of those earlier incidences as a police officer. So I had a webinar the other day from health professionals at a large hospital in New England. And one of the questions that they submitted was, how do I protest on my job, about my job, without losing my job? And I think the thing that I want to make sure your listeners hear, or whoever's going to attend to this, is listen, if you ever lose a job or a relationship or an opportunity because you stood on the right side of justice, you still will never lose any sleep. Your morality is not for sale, and your conscience needs to be clear when you lie down at night. Now, I am a working poor professional with 4, 5, 6 jobs and some side hustles too. So I'm not ever going to help people lose their jobs. I'm not ever going to encourage people to not be able to pay their bills. But if at the end of the day, I can't protest and I can't speak my voice and I there's something I need to do to stand on the right side of justice, I will lose that job. I've been fortunate in that's not happened to me at really very many times in my life, but I will lose a job. Because my morality is not for sale. So I just hope that we get a chance to talk about these brave police officers, whether they're doing it for optics or not. I want to talk about how one of the things that gives me the greatest hope in this moment is police officers and National Guardsmen and women, you know, who are saying, yeah, this is ridiculous. I'm going to have to take a knee. Or, yeah, we're going to march with you. We're going to hold this sign that says we stand in solidarity as a police officer. Because, yeah, I'm human and this is outrageous. That's the only thing that keeps me going these days, Captain Hunter.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And I certainly appreciate the gesture on their part. What I am skeptical of is that we have been down this road so many times, as you know. And I am, while the new thing with the police officers kneeling and walking and protesting. And I saw the sheriff from Flint and the chief of the Denver Police Department, all that kind of stuff, which is great. But as a famous musical lyricist once said, are these people going to be around when the beef cooks? And what I mean by that is if and when these legislatures and Congress start doing their probes and saying, okay, we want to make these changes, where are you going to be then? And that's what I'm very fearful of. It's one thing to get us to protest peacefully, because that's, I don't want to be cynical, but I want to make sure that it's not just a ploy to say, okay, we're going to protest peacefully, not throw urine-soaked stuff at us and all that kind of stuff. But then in 6 months from now, when we start all the reform movements that all these people want, well, listen, we can't really give that up. Well, we can't do this, right? Because that's exactly what happened this is what happened when the state of California wanted to change their laws for the use of deadly force. The standard was nationally is reasonable. California changed it to necessary. So in other words, is the standard a police officer going to take someone else's life? Is that what a reasonable officer would do at this place, this time, given these sudden circumstances? That was how they analyzed everything. State mm-hmm. of California said, no, it's got to be necessary. In other words, mm-hmm. what other steps did you take before you decide to pull the trigger? So all these police unions fought all that kind of stuff. So my point is that going forward, when they want to make these reforms, Where are those same chiefs going to be? You going to march with us then, right? That's my complete train of thinking. And also, we talked about the Minnesota, and I'll let you jump in here. I want to interview you, the chief of police of Minnesota, right? He's down there taking knees and all this kind of stuff. But you're the same chief of police that let this man out there with 18 complaints against him. I do not know if those complaints were sustained or not, but don't show me that you can kneel now and that you're sorry now. You want to take your hat off and show all this deference now, but you had a chance 17, 16, 15. You had a chance to get this man out of here. So I'm just saying, and he's a man of color, right? I don't know if he's Hispanic or half, I don't know what he is, but you had your chance and your opportunity. Now, listen, I know what I'm saying is maybe controversial. I should be standing up for law enforcement. But this is the facts. This is the facts. Is that you had this chance to get this thing right, and you kind of blew it.
So I want to offer something that's probably a little bit more conciliatory, because I think this is a moment in history. We are at a point. We are at an inflection point, right? I think that there's a way that we as Black people and African Americans and citizens can win this. And I also think that there's a way that police officers and law enforcement can win this, right? I mean, and again, I told you, I warned you, I was a perpetual optimist, right? But let me just tell you what I think. So first of all, you know, I hate to pull like, oh, you know, my family members are police. But so I have a black African-American black brother-in-law who spent years as a police officer, right? He was like the SWAT team dude, and he was an investigator for several years. The gravity of what police officers do, and investigators and anybody who's in law, the gravity of what you do is not lost on me. Right. I know that you put yourselves in harm's way. I know that your charge is to serve and protect. And I also know that your charge is to help us keep the peace. I've had to call the police. I've called the police in my own home when I was scared. I've called when there was a drug operation on my street. I called when I thought someone broke into my basement, because I live alone, right? So I know that in my own life, what it means for me to have called you when I needed you. So I think the first thing that I could do as a citizen is just to honor your profession and say thank you that you would, it's almost like being in the military. Thank you that you would regularly go into places where people are trying to make a living by selling drugs and where people are being violent. You know, as a survivor of a marriage, you know, with abuse, like, thank you for coming into our homes and helping us settle disputes and getting, you know, nasty men off. But like, thank you, you know, for what you do. I think that the people in your organization and the structures that over empower you are undermining you. I think that police officers have too much power, right? And I think that some of that too much power comes from the fact that when that you can kill somebody and that you tend not to be convicted, that you tend not to be punished. I think that as long as we could establish some type of system where your power is counterbalanced by responsibility, right? That by accountability, right? Because with great power comes great responsibility. So if we could somehow equalize the power you have, because let me just give you one example. I was in my late 30s, right? I'm 41 years old. I was in my late 30s when I realized, I love that you look shocked. I was in my late 30s when I realized that when a police officer stops you, like for a moving violation, I did not realize until my late 30s that you have the power to let us go. I did not realize that when the police officer is your first point of contact with law enforcement, I didn't realize that other people were getting warnings. Because as a woman of color with, of course, African-American hair, I've never been given a warning. I've actually been given 3 tickets in a row for things that I didn't even understand, right? So what I'm saying to you is, from the moment that you choose to pull us over, to the moment you choose to cite us or issue violations or citations or whatever it is you do, you have incredible power to determine how much money and time and legal counsel we're going to have to need to overturn what you did based on your power. And when you kill us, the fact that assaulting a police officer is a felony, right? The fact that touching you, spitting on you, throwing something at you is a felony, that means that we have an incredible, you know, gap in power. Because no matter what I do, number one, your word is actually worth more. You are literally the law. So the first part I want to say is I appreciate what you all do, because we cannot live in a society that is lawless. But what I also want to say is, based on the fact that you have too much power and it hasn't been counterbalanced with enough responsibility and just simple accountability, that's what engenders distrust, and that's what makes your job harder. I believe personally that the overwhelming majority of police officers are incredible people who are not looking to abuse their power. There's something about law enforcement they love. Maybe they loved sirens when they were children. Maybe they're from a family of people. Maybe they love this country and they want to make sure that they do their part to safeguard everyone's freedom, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Maybe that's how they are civically engaged. So what I love about police officers is that, you know, most of you, I think, are that. But I think that there are some of you, and I think that there in your institution are moments where you are too powerful and not accountable enough, right? There's too much power and there's not enough accountability. So to be frank, the way that we all win is that we support you by saying that we are not protesting you as people. We are protesting your power. We are protesting your abuse of power, and we are protesting excessive force and police brutality, not by all of you, obviously, but by systems that protect some of you, you know, from when you do that. And then I think that in return, I think that what we should do is to make it so that we could have these cross coalitions of fighting for justice together. Right? You already do things like community policing. We had a DARE officer in every school, right? Now he wasn't there to surveil, he wasn't there to jail, and he wasn't there to arrest. He was there to help us see a positive police presence in our lives, in middle, elementary, and secondary school, and high school, right? So I know I'm not telling you anything new, but saying, hey, maybe you could hold hands with us and like build a basketball court and have programs. I know you do that, but I mean something bigger. I mean something more coordinated, and I mean something that changes the law and something that changes the structures that protect you, right? So that you can do your job, right? I think that there's a way that we can win here.
Very good. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I like that. That was well said. In your line of racism work, anti-racism work, racism work, so tell us about the pushback that you get from people, black people whining, what about black on black crime? Tell us about the typical pushback that you get in your
life. Wow. Yeah. So for somebody who was a professor for 17 years, consultant for, you know, about 16 of those 17 years. I've really heard it all. But I think it'd probably be more productive to talk about what it's rooted in. So part of what I talked about in my article is that when you get like resistant and intransigent and intractable white people, sometimes it's just literally a function of a lack of knowledge about the experiences of Black people and people of color, and what I like to call global majorities, right? Because we can forget, like, white people are so powerful, it will make you forget that white people are actually a global minority. So the word minority is actually really not accurate. But I think that the way we teach people, which is why I started off my career as an early childhood educator, because I wanted to get kids on the first day of the first day of school. And I wanted to make sure they knew, you know, maintain their sense of justice, and that they understood the full human record, that there were people of all ilk all over the world and in this country, right? So I think that the way we educate people, which is sort of steeped in whiteness, right? Here are all the white people who have done great things. Here are all the white men who have ever invented and said and researched anything that's important. The way we educate people is highly detrimental, not only to people of color, but also to white people, because they miss the opportunity to recognize that they are not better than other human beings, right? Again, they're socialized curricularly to think that they're better. Yes.
I want to ask you about how you phrase that they're missing out on something. Do you really think that they think that they're missing out on something? Do they know that they're missing out on something? Because I think that they think that they're the end all be all. And I don't mean that in the way that it just came out. If anyone, yeah. People are listening to this. Yeah. But I'm saying that, I mean, if you tell them this, you tell them that they're the best, and that you've done all these things and you invented all this stuff and the world is yours, why would they think that that's a negative? Why would they want to give up that power? That would be my next question as going on, is we did all this, why should we give that up? And that's, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you know what? I had to write an entire article on that very question, right? It's the one that I sent you, the PDF, about like interests, right? Like, yeah, what are white people's interests? Not only, I actually think I know pretty much what their interests are in races, which it's profitable. It keeps me in power. It's comfortable. I'm the best, you know. But then I really started to think about, but white people are damaged by racism too, right? Like, but it's subtle and it's more nuanced, but it's real.
How are they damaged by it? If you can break that down for us, how are they actually damaged by it?
So let me give you an example. So you know how when it was legal for us to go out to dinner,
I'm trying to think of the 1940s. I'm like, what is legal for us to go? I'm thinking, you're talking about 2 weeks ago.
Look, I'm talking about in January. Okay, we could go out to eat. But that's hilarious, because that's why we had to protest at that Woolworth lunch counter, right? We could pick up food in the back, but not.
Right.
Okay, that's good. I like that. But so, when I would often go to a restaurant in downtown DC, and there's homelessness, like, you know, in every city, but like there's a preponderance of homelessness. And I remember I would be walking to a restaurant, like I'm trying to go to, you know, Kith and Kin, for example, and I would be like stepping over people who were wrapped up in these Mylar blankets, or people would just kind of be on the street, and I would be passing them on the way to go have a $200 dinner. Okay, so if I'm fully human, I am affected by what I just saw. I cannot fully enjoy my dinner if I'm looking at that thinking, how is it that I'm about to have a $200 dinner and this person is literally digging through the trash can, right? I mean, some people look at homeless and think, well, you know, that's their fault and they shouldn't do it, but they're still affected by that. Like, it's unpleasant to see, right? So I think that white people have the same experiences. I'm sorry, but if you're a white person, just like those people that you talked about who are like, yeah, I'm a police officer, this is outrageous, you're looking at the news. And even if you don't like Black people, and even if you halfway think that George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor deserve to die, you are negatively affected by the fact that that's happening. And the human in you is not okay with it. This is what I was talking about in the article this morning. Racism costs you your humanity, because you have to do an incredible amount of work, number one, to deny the presence of racism. You have to deny that it's bad. It takes more work to be a racist than it does to be an anti-racist. If you are an anti-racist white person, you are free. You are psychologically free. You are emotionally free. And you can even help yourself get socioeconomically free by sharing resources and by supporting, you know, racial justice. But when you are a racist, you are in bondage. You are committing, you are expressing willful ignorance, and you are still, you are still affected by racism. So I've written an article, like, why would white people want to dismantle a system that systemically advantages them? What is the motivation there? Why would I want to give that up? Because what you gain in return, which is your full humanity, is worth it. You know, my daddy used to say, honey bun, anything that costs you your peace is too expensive. And none of us can afford racism, not even white people. That's my response to that.
I will defer to your expertise. I think that for people who are middle to upper middle to downright rich, that white thing's really working out for them. I'm going to be honest. I mean, and to give that, and that's why I think the problem is we have to convince people to give that up. And as long as, even if they're the middle to lower middle class, they always think that they had that shot. They always think that they had that shot that one day I can catch my break. And if we allow more people, persons of color, into this particular circle with this limited resources, even though we know that there are really no limited resources, we have enough.
They're unlimited.
Right. We have enough.
Not a pie. Yeah.
Right. Food, and food. We have enough food and everything else to go around. Yep. We know that.
But if we
have been tricked into believing that I have to, keep certain people out so I can have more. There was a podcast I was listening to the other day, and I meant to listen to it again so I could get the exact term that they used, but it was something along the lines of something about access to resources. That was like the as long as I have access to resource, right? If I'm a middle class white person and I have this certain access to resource, right? I can make sure that my kids have access to resource and that my grandkids can have it. I can send them to the best schools and we can get this best job. But if I'll just take the police world again, right? The town that I live in is mostly Italian and Irish, as far as white majority, right? Once you start letting black people in, right? That's less Irish people that are going to be coming in, and their access to the power of being a police officer and the wages of being a police officer, right? That's another white family who can't buy a house. And that, I think, is causes some resentment. And that is something that I don't think that they want to give up. We can take this all the way back to what we started at the beginning of the conversation, is that they don't want to give this stuff up. I mean, and I think that, that's why I want to go with, it's a hard road to go. And so how is your work in how productive is your work? I don't know if you take statistics or anybody else does, or how is it working? Do you hear from people 5 years later, 10 years later saying you changed my life? And can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we have this this adage in teaching where it's like you will never know the full extent of your reach, you know, when you're a teacher. And so it is incredibly gratifying to see instant results, you know, just even in a 3 month semester, right, you know, where students, you know, you could see them making progress. But how productive am I? I like to think that I'm living a life worth living, right? And that I am fighting against something that looks like it's permanent, but doesn't have to be permanent, right? I come from the school of critical race theory, right? Established by Derrick Bell. And one of his tenets of critical race theory, right, is that there's racial realism, which is that racism is never going to go away, right? I talk about this in the Interest Convergence article. Like, we will only make as much racial progress as keeps white people in power and comfortable. Okay, so if it doesn't coincide,
yeah.
Don't be tempted. Don't be seduced by racial realism. I'm telling you, there's a better way. Okay.
What's that racist guy? Jared Taylor talks about that.
Okay, I don't know Jared Taylor. I don't know Jared.
Well, he's a white racist. He's a racist, but he talks about racial. He calls himself a racial realist. So I didn't know if him and Derrick Bell were kind of on the same page with that. But he says the same thing. But go on.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, but that's interesting though, right? Because that's interest convergence right there. Like, Derrick Bell couldn't possibly be more emblematic of anti-racism. But part of what he talks about in his literature is this is never going to go away. This is profitable, right? This has real and tangible benefit for white people. It is a system of systems. It is fundamental and foundational to the founding of this country. And not just this country. I mean, we can think about colonialism and the global reach, right, of whiteness and white racial dominance. But I have a slightly different tack, okay? Like, you talk about like how productive are you, right? Like, so people, yeah, I mean, I guess it would be great if I had some data that says, you know, I've turned this many minds on, I've changed this many hearts. So what I see is I see real and tangible racial progress. And that's how I know we are at least chipping away. We may not be winning, right? Because like streets are on fire. So we're clearly not winning today. But you know, the victory, we can't call it a victory today. But neither is it a Pyrrhic victory, right? It's like a real victory. So there's progress. So let me just give you tangible examples of where I think there's actual progress. I am from Virginia. Right. And for anybody who's ever seen the movie Loving or is aware of sort of anti-miscegenation laws. Okay. We repealed those, right? Like it's still legal in all but three states to marry a child, but it's legal in all states to have I know you got to look that up. It is true. Only three states have banned it. Like you can marry a child, but in all states you can have interracial marriage, right? Sometimes there's resistance and you'll see a news story every now and again about somebody who won't, you know, issue a marriage license. But, you know, for example, we own to this day, my dad passed away years ago, but we own a plot of land in New Jersey. Because that was one of the only places that a black man could have a non-black wife and have that be legal and go and build a house. So even though, you know, we eventually settled back in Roanoke City, my mom being Asian, just think about how now, okay, like it's legal, right? Like laws do pass and laws do change. I know earlier you had referenced some of the legal reforms that need to happen affecting, you know, the institution of law enforcement. But I mean, but laws do pass and laws do change. You know, thank goodness we have the right to vote, right? As black people, the state of Florida is still trying to use poll taxes to keep us from doing that. We still are tying the ability to vote to criminality, right? Which it makes, I don't understand that. I mean, maybe I understand how you can have a gun, but why you can't vote? Like, I don't know how. So, you know, we still have the 13th Amendment, right? Which is problematic. It's got that huge loophole in it for how you can sort of still basically have slavery and how it's still basically legal. But I mean, we did have the official abolition of slavery in 1865. So I guess what I'm saying is over the course of time, we are chipping away at legal, right? Or de jure, de jure racism, right? But we're not necessarily making as much progress on de facto racism, right? Which is the fact of the matter, the reality of the situation. So I'm committed to just chipping away. Statistics don't change people's hearts and minds. I use data, but mostly I use stories. Stories change hearts and minds. And I do diversity trainings. I write. 140,000 people have actually viewed the Ahmaud Arbery article. And most of the responses are from white people. Again, my mailboxes are flooded. So I'm encouraged by the white people who read my articles. I'm encouraged by the fact that I get paid to dismantle racism. I was a teacher and I did it in a classroom. Then I was a professor and I did it with teachers. And then I got a job, you know, with the Department of Defense. So I did it within the confines of federal government and the military. We serve every branch of the military at the National Defense University. And now I'm about to step into a new career at the National Institutes of Health. So I'm going to be fighting racism within the confines of health inequity, because we know that COVID-19 is killing a disproportionate number of black people, brown people, indigenous people, and people experiencing poverty. So the fact that I am making people pay for racism by having to hire someone like me to come into their organization, to me, it's the most subversive act ever. So I don't know how productive I am in terms of how many people I've been able to, whose minds I've been able to change, or, you know, whose hearts I've been able to turn. But I do know that the fact that we have chief diversity officers and that we have regular racial conversation as part of the national dialogue, that's progress. And to me, that's undeniable.
Well said. I wish you the best of success going forward. So what articles, I'm going to let you go here because I kept you on here for a little while here. What articles are you working on now? You got a new job. Congratulations on that. And what Thank can you. We expect? What is the, well, first tell us about the articles that you're working on and all that kind of stuff. And if people can contact you or whatever you got going on.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for giving me this platform. So the article that I just shared with you this morning and I just wrote, I was up all night, couldn't sleep. Same thing with Jordan Davis, just couldn't sleep. I wrote an article called If You Are More Outraged by the Destruction of Property Than the Destruction of Black Lives, Your Outrage is Misplaced, A Guide for White People Who Need Help Processing the Protests. Okay, I am deeply disturbed by the news coverage. I've had to stop watching the news because now we're focusing on looting and now we're focusing, they're not even protests anymore. They're just riots. Now we're focusing on riots. People are missing the point. And most importantly, white people are missing the opportunity to stand in solidarity with us. We don't need you necessarily out in the streets. I can't even go out in the streets based on my health status, right? So we don't need people to necessarily support us by physically protesting, but there are lots of other types of things that white people can do. And there's some things in that article that sort of lead people down a path of understanding why we're protesting and why you should be angry. So the other article that I'm thinking about writing is called Police Officers, You Can Have It Both Ways. You can stand in solidarity with us and you can keep your job. And most importantly, you can regain your humanity. The only thing that keeps me from weeping constantly is these shows of solidarity from police officers, okay? You are on the front lines. You can determine which neighborhoods you're gonna patrol. You can determine whether you're gonna let us off with a warning and or give us a citation. You can decide how long you're going to detain us, right? It can't, whatever you're looking up can't possibly take that long. You can determine what we're going to be charged with. You can determine whether and how we're going to be arrested, right? Whether we're going to be hogtied, whether we're going to be handcuffed, whether we're going to be zip tied. You can be the officer in Florida who literally arrested a six-year-old black girl. You can decide in that moment whether that's necessary. So I have a lot of hope for police officers, and I want to appeal to law enforcement directly, you know, and say, you can have it both ways. There are ways that you can truly do your job. Your job is to serve us and to protect us, not to surveil us and to kill us. That's not your job. I know sometimes that happens. And I know sometimes you have to shoot bad guys, perps. I get it. I understand. There are enough law enforcement officers in my family that I understand your job. I really do. But there's a way that you can help us achieve and enjoy the American dream, just like all other white people, just like everyone else, by treating us fairly under the law. You enforce the law. You don't always make the law, right? But you enforce the law, and you are the first people we contact when we come, you know, in contact with the law. So I think I'm going to write an article for your people because I am sustained by officers who take a knee. I am sustained by sheriffs who march with us. I am sustained by police officers who don't shoot us and who hug us and, you know, say, hey, what do you need? This is how you get to, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about law enforcement officers. So I'm going to write an article about that too.
Very good. I'm not going to take that hope away from you. Very good.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
I would love to have you back on sometime to talk about your work and everything else that you're doing. Thank you so Absolutely. Much. Thank you so much for coming on. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. You just don't know. So you've been very positive, and I'm going to take that positivity through the screen here and really kind of embrace it. So thank you.
Can I leave you with something? Can I give you? I know you got to go, but I want to leave you a second.
Listen, I got all night. I want to keep you. I try to be very cognizant of you.
You're very mindful of time and respectful. I appreciate it. But let me just leave you with this. So I was interviewing, as part of my research on anti-racist white people, I was interviewing Tim Wise. And he talked about how there's always a balance between hope and reality, right? If you're too hopeful when you look at racism, then you will be naive, right? And so you can't be too hopeful because then you'll start to deny racism and you'll be too Pollyanna-ish and you won't actually be effective in the fight for racial and social justice. But if you have too much doubt, and if you buy into racial realism and the inevitability of racism too much, then you become cynical, right? So if you have too much doubt, and if you have too much realism and too much racial realism in you, you will say this is never going to change, right? That's never going to get better. We always going to be shot down like dogs in the street. So then you become cynical, and then you become ineffective in a different way. The goal is to balance hope with reality, so you can maintain your hopefulness and so you can keep going and live a life worth living, but to have just enough doubt and cynicism to have to critically consume the media, to really look at a photo and be like, wait a minute, you didn't cover this story the way you're, to really look at those state capitol rushers and assault rifle carriers and be like, wait a minute, where was their so you have to have some degree of doubt and reality and some degree of cynicism, to be quite frank, if you're going to be effective in this fight. But I would ask you to bring up your hope and to keep functioning where you are with realism, because you are, sir, you are a retired police captain. So I have no right to tell you to tone down your cynicism, because you've seen a lot, you've been through a lot, you've done a lot, and you continue to do a lot. I think the fact that you have this podcast says everything about your hopefulness. And I think you're probably more hopeful than you think. But I just would offer that we don't want to be cynical, but we also don't want to be naive. And I understand that. I understand that.
I take that criticism. Thank you very much, Doctor.
No, it was not.
I know. No.
Listen in wisdom.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I certainly take it. And you know what? You're right. I do try to be positive. And I, mm-hmm. you're right. That is why I started the podcast, because I want to try to bridge that divide. But sometimes you just mm-hmm. get these punches in the gut, and it's just like, oh man, you know. So anyway, I'm going to have you back on. We're going to continue to talk about it. I really, really, really appreciate it. You have no idea how much I appreciate it. And I keep your emails, because the excitement that you wrote in the emails is like, oh man, I don't know anybody who's this excited. So thank you so much. So thank you. And I will talk to you soon. So you'll be definitely hearing from me. So take care. Wear your mask. Wash your hands. And all that kind of good stuff. You know. So.
I will do it, Captain Hunter. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the platform. Okay.